Welcome to this exciting episode of Talking Pork, the podcast created for the food service hospitality industry. I'm your host, Vanessa Barnes, the Business Development Manager for Australian Pork, and our guest today is Chef Adam Moore.
Hello.
Welcome, Adam.
Thank you.
It's so good to have you here. We're really delighted to have you here on the show today. We have so much to discuss. You make such a wonderful contribution and celebrate so many chefs. I felt it was time that we sat down and had a chat to you about you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So let's start at the beginning, Adam. Tell us, why food? Why do hospitality?
Why hospitality? I started when I was 13, really where I wanted to go. I had a teacher that really... she was a principal. She'd come in because the teacher was sick. So she asked questions and said, you know, where do you want to be in 5 years? That general homework question. And I went home and that night I sat down and looked at my life and where I really wanted to be. And it was
How old were you?
13.
13. That's a big question to ask yourself.
But I took it a lot longer than 5 years. I took it a little bit beyond that. And I wrote down a list and I think it was about 280 goals that I needed to achieve in my life to say where I wanted to be. And I even wanted to be a chef, a teacher, or work in theatre, movies, sound and lighting. I love drama. So I had those three aspects of my role. And it's quite funny that if I look back 25 years into my career, I've become a teacher. I'm doing sound and lighting on TV and radio and other things, and I'm a chef. So I've actually combined all my careers into the one, which is so exciting. But food was something that I love food. My grandparents, both sides, one would get up in the morning and bake, and it was fascinating to see that. And the other one, she would always talk about recipes and have this clip out of all these women's weekly recipes. And it was just something that resonated more with me, and it was probably the strongest in my goal platform. And yeah, I was a male cooking in a co-ed school that was first male to really cook in school. I was probably the smartest one because I got the admiration of other females in the class, so it was quite good.
That was your flirting power.
That was my flirting power. And I think a lot of the other guys caught on and started taking on.
Started a trend
because I went to a very strict Catholic school. It was co-ed, and you had to be someone that went to university. And my principal at the time was not impressed that I was looking to be a chef. And all of a sudden, all these males were going to the class. They realised it was just a bludge class for them. But a trend started. And it was interesting when I applied myself to go into as an apprentice, I sent about 300 applications out. A boy from Penrith didn't get many responses back, which is interesting. The day before LinkedIn, before Seek, before
Internet. This was Centrelink days, right? This is back when Centrelink actually had an office.
Yep.
And they used to put them up on little postcards on the wall,
I had a typewriter. I didn't even have an electric typewriter. It was just a typewriter, and I typed my resume on that. And not to get responses was probably the most disheartening at the time.
Yeah.
I got about 18 responses from those 300.
Right.
And
that's
out of that.
Not a bad score.
It wasn't too bad. I thought it would be more. And out of that, there was only three interviews. One was at Core Hotels, which was Novotel at the time, our opening team. The other one was in a restaurant in Sydney. I think it was an Italian restaurant. I can't remember the name. And the other one was Qantas Airline Catering. And funnily enough, day before I got my apprenticeship, or before I knew I got my apprenticeship, I had worked so hard in Novotel and Qantas doing all these elimination stages of cooking. I bought a bottle of champagne and I said to my mum, someone's going to call me. I'm going to have a job tomorrow. And it was funny, I got a phone call. The first call was a Core Hotels, Novotel Darling Harbour, which I started my whole career with. 3 hours later, Qantas rang me, but I had already accepted Novotel.
Yeah.
And little did I know that a friend of mine that I went to school with went to Qantas and years later was made redundant in mid-apprenticeship. And I started the best journey on the planet.
I have to agree with you. In all of the years that I've been in this industry myself, Accor Hotels has definitely been the platform or the launching pad to many a wonderful career for many chefs.
Yeah, it was when I first went to Novotel Darling Harbour, which was the first Accor hotel in Australia, it was opening up. Accor was not a name. Mm. A lot of people didn't know Novotel. And I stayed my 4 years at Novotel Darling Harbour under a great chef called Reinhard Reutner.
Oh, yes, yes.
Who now works in Singapore with Rick Stevens, Dr. Rick. And Reinhard was the best mentor that really started this passion. Like, I think I had the passion all along, but he really flamed that passion. And those 4 years, if I were to look at my career now, that was where it set me up where I am today. It gave me the knowledge and the learning, yearning, essentially going out there to really find everything about food. You know, he would get, Reinhard would get of us LaRousse Gastronomique, mm-hmm. my Bible, and he said to all apprentices, he hired 3 apprentices every year, and he would train them and develop them throughout their life. So there was some above, just above me, and I was like the second intake of apprentices. And LaRousse Gastronomique, he says, okay, you've got to read 5 pages on a Friday afternoon, and Monday I'm just going to give you a page number. I'm going to say, tell me what this is. So, for example, you could, you know, in the C section, it might be Chateaubriand. Adam, tell me what a Chateaubriand is, or Adam, go make me a Chateaubriand.
Mm.
And it was really intriguing that he gave us homework.
So just for the listeners that are listening and they don't understand what a Chateaubriand is, would you like to explain?
So Chateaubriand is the head of the fillet. Essentially, it's normally traditionally was in the 70s and 80s was a dish that was served between 2 people. It's the most tender part of the fillet, and it's just – unbelievable part of a beef fillet that you cut up, and they would traditionally, when gueridon service, where your food was brought to the table and cooked to it, the Chateaubriand was already cooked but sliced at the table, shared between the two. And it was really interesting and was served with the accompaniments like sauces and things like that as well.
And your turned veggies.
And my turned vegetables. So it was quite interesting to have that part of my career. The other thing Reinhard did was fascinating. I had a day off on Wednesdays, and I lived in Penrith. I was working in Darling Harbour, so it was really hard to get into the city. And every Wednesday, for some reason, was my day off, because I think it was after TAFE. And Wednesday for 4 years, I only missed about 3 times, but Reinhard would make me come into the fish markets. I had to be there at 5 o'clock. Between 5 and 7, I had to walk around with a notebook, writing down the prices of prawns. Now, back in those days, we had a full brigade of chefs, nearly 60 chefs back then, and we spent in an average between $200,000 to $300,000 a week on seafood, because we had grandeur, you know, seafood buffets, and we'd spend a lot on prawns and oysters and whole fish, amazing whole fishes, everything from a moonfish right through to, you know, tunas, you know, snappers, all those sort of fun things. You go there and you look at the prices, and he would make me compare. And then he would arrive at 7 o'clock. Between 7 and 9 o'clock, we would work with the buyer, and we'd say, this is what we're going. And he'd say, yep, prawns are at, you know, X amount of dollars. And he'll go, Adam, what was the price? And I would give him a benchmark of the cheapest price in the market that I saw that day versus the most expensive. And I say, well, this is the one. And then we would negotiate our prices. 9 o'clock, we sat down for coffee. It was always Italian, Turkish, or Greek coffee. That's my love of coffee today. And from 9 o'clock to 12 o'clock, I filleted fish in the filleting room.
Wow.
On my day off. And I still remember my mum used to argue, why are you doing this? You're only getting paid $2.30 an hour. You're not getting paid to do this. But it was interesting. I now know I have a love of fish, mm-hmm. which I didn't have before, and I know how to fill it.
Which is a skill in itself. And I can tell you there's not a lot of people out there that know how to fillet a fish.
And I think I appreciate it too, the wastage of, you know, and using fish correctly. Make my stock. Yeah. Also things like using the entrails in different things and farces, which is a big trend, you know, like Josh Nealon with the fish butchery.
Mm-hmm.
But back then we were learning those things. I was lucky that we had our own butchery. So we learned not only to the beef and lamb carcasses, but pork.
Yeah.
We would get whole pig in and break it down. And that is fascinating for me because that learning, that hands-on training, you're never going to replicate. That is the part where I think also if you've got a passion, that's where you want to learn more. And it's funny, I actually end up doing butchery as a course later on in my life because I was so fascinated by the animal. You know, that nose to tail and, you know, everything but the squeal, essentially you got to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And Reinhard would let us and the rest of the team and the sous chefs, you would create dishes for the buffet or specials. And so if the things that you couldn't use regularly, you can put them on the buffet as a special. And that was fascinating.
It is fascinating. And I think when you go back and you have a look at that whole model of a hotel, they have so many outlets that they can use so many different products. It's, you know, they've got what? They've got to feed their staff. They have room service. They've got breakfast buffets, amazing.
We had our own pastry. We even did buffets. So we would have our own ice carver who would come in 2 days a week.
And they're not buffets like we know buffets to be today.
No, they were grand. The ice carvings, you would have different ice carvings all the time. Even functions back then were impressive.
That's right, yeah.
So
it has changed a lot when you look at the way that we do food today. I mean, it's a lot more simplified and just the whole eating behavior has changed considerably.
But also the training skills too. All the products are pre-cut, pre-portioned. You know, not a lot of chefs had the privilege of what I get from my apprenticeship to cut down a whole pig and learn, you know, make the mistakes early. You know, when I'm doing it, I'm very careful of how you cut around the bone or, you know, how much flesh you take off or, you know, if you're taking sinew, are you taking flesh as well? You know, that sort of thing. So a lot of young people don't get that knowledge today, which is probably the disappointing part.
I think it is. I mean, look, that's such a big topic for a whole other discussion, I think. But it is something that I would love to sit down with you at some point and have a chat about because I do believe that there is a whole array of subjects we can talk about when we talk about the butchering side of a business or even making salamis. I mean, it goes so much further.
The other thing which can be applied today is when I had money, my paycheck come in.
What
I
was that? How much was that, like $80 or something?
Yeah, it was really – so get paid for 40 hours and then, you had to try and make.
It cost you $10 for the bus or the train.
Yeah. Or petrol if you had a car, if you're lucky. But also I worked other jobs to suffice that. So I'd always set aside money for three things. I would have an equipment kind of portion. So I think I'd put aside 5% just for equipment. So I'd save up for a piece. And the first piece of equipment I ever bought was a copper fry pan, which I still have in my toolkit today.
I'm not surprised.
And I've used it on a lot of TV sets and things like that. And it's probably well loved now. It's probably you wouldn't recognize it's a copper pan, but it was the best pan and did lots of competitions. Second thing I would always say was save money for books and cookbooks.
Yeah.
I have a collection hitting now nearly close to 6,000 cookbooks from around the world.
You have a whole room just dedicated just to books, right?
Cookbooks. Let's define it. So there are other books in my collection that are separate from that, but this is 6,000 cookbooks.
So those four books, I think it was, that I borrowed from you 2 years ago wouldn't even be missed, right?
They're probably my favourite subjects on charcuterie, which was great. But no, I love books and I love collecting books. But at the same time, I also had another component where I would have some money for ingredients and I would just go to the Dave Jones Food Hall and back in the day and buy, you know, something that was unique. What was a quince? And then I would play with it and experiment. And I think in those early days, I really started to play with flavor, which was very important for my career a lot later in my life, playing with those ingredients that I didn't know. So those three things, I think you can set aside money for those if you're really passionate about what you do. Learn from books, like, they are amazing, you know, and that's where I learned from so many great leaders and mentors in this industry. But also, I created my own style because of these books and inspiration. Having equipment, my love of knives and that now, I love getting my own custom-made stuff. But back then, you know, I had Victorinox when I first started. And
I had Mundell.
I started with Mundell just after Victorinox. I think I took Victorinox to TAFE because I was afraid people were going to steal it.
They were too expensive for me.
And a Mundell was good, but they were forever to sharpen.
They were, yeah. But I was a queen sharpener, so it didn't matter. I like to look good, you know, sharpening my knife on my steel.
I think everyone has that stage in their life. You start with a basic knife, then you'll go to a European style. Then you kind of move into an American or a UK brand, and then you go your Japanese, and then you kind of go your custom. So I think at your later end of your life, you go your customs when you can afford them. But you start out, you know, Victorinox or Mundell or whatever they were, you would practice your stones.
Absolutely.
And chef, my whole kitchen brigade would check your knives when you come in. It was such an important skill, and I think we do lose that now. I don't think we don't have time for it. Guys, have your knife sharpened. It's not that hard.
Mm. But even the use of different knives and how they're applied, you know, I mean, I've seen chefs in competition work that are using filleting knives to cut vegetables.
Or paring knives to do filleting.
I know, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. Use the right tool for the right occasion. And it's interesting. They are different knives for different reasons. There is different equipment for different, you know, you had a bird's beak, which was a turning knife. You had your filleting knife. You also had your butchering knife.
And your bread knife.
You had your bread knife.
Whatever the knife needed to be for the specific.
And if you did carvery, you had a ham slicer.
Yes.
So,
yeah. So we touched slightly before at the very beginning of your journey, and you mentioned Women's Weekly.
Yes.
Was that a big source of inspiration for you? Is that where you started to play around with the fundamentals of cooking?
I still remember, it was probably the inspiration when I was young at school, because I really wanted to be better than all the girls in class. So I would look at Women's Weekly, and there was almost a case where that come against me. So the very first dish.
Why? Because you started getting better than the girls?
Yeah, but I also decided to take my very first dish home to my parents. I bought all the ingredients for my family at the time, and I cooked apricot chicken.
Oh.
My very first dish. And
that's a family favorite.
Not in my family. It's not. It's something that caused World War III. Essentially, my mum, my dad, and my brother at the time did not like it, and they ordered takeout back then because it was too foreign for them, the apricot chicken. And that almost stopped me becoming a chef. And it was a Women's Weekly recipe that almost undone me. So, yes, although Women's Weekly, a very important staple in a lot of people's homes, in general, houses, it was also my undoing. So it's quite funny. So I've never cooked apricot chicken since. I have made recipes with apricot chicken, but I dread when I see that come up.
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to bring it up one day and we're going to cook it together.
Yeah, we'll do it with pork, though.
Oh, definitely. Apricot definitely. Pork. There we go. 100%. If you enjoyed listening, stay tuned for part two. For more information, please email us at inspired@australianpork.com.au or sign up to receive our informative newsletters at www.inspiredbyaustralianpork.com.au. Until next time, I'm Vanessa Barnes, and don't forget, get more pork on your menu.